Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. There is an election forthcoming on Sunday, the 25th. Right now, 18 candidates for the presidency. You will recall Mr. Yanukovych, the elected president, fled in February. And since then, there's been no president. There, in fact, has been no government from the point of view of Moscow and its supporters. There's been an interim government with the prime minister, with the president making remarks through these weeks of turmoil, but no elected government, and that makes everyone's position extremely tenuous. So, the election on Sunday. The candidates themselves, we'll get to that in a moment, consist of the full range of large voices, but they're led by a man, I kid you not, the chocolate king of Ukraine. In fact, I'm told his chocolate is so good that it's very popular in Moscow and Berlin throughout Europe. The chocolate king is the leading candidate. Follow this story with Professor Stephen Cohen, who joins me tonight. Steve is the author of two prescient pieces these last weeks that he's published at The Nation. You can find them on The Nation website. The first was about the new Cold War, who's responsible, and the second, Cold War Without Debate, that written with his colleague and publisher of The Nation, Katrina Vandenhovel. Steve, a very good evening to you. I go to the election because the first fact that we need to establish is that it's going to happen. There are doubts about whether the polls throughout the country will be available, but the Germans are saying that they will have 1,000 observers for the presidential polling. The OECD will contribute observers, 2,784 from 19 countries, in fact, including 19 international organizations. So it very much looks like the election will go forward. Will this election resolve Ukraine? Good evening to you, Steve.
It sounds a little bit like a Russian anecdote. More monitors showed up than voters. This could actually happen in some towns in eastern Ukraine, where it's far from clear that registered voters who so oppose the Kiev government that they also oppose this election for president that the Kiev government has called, that they will show up in large numbers. That's a question mark. I think we ought to begin, John, by asking why this election is taking place at all. And you pointed it to the answer in your forward to our discussion, that the government in Kiev, which the United States embraces, came to power through a kind of street coup. It wasn't elected. It overthrew the elected president. So it, that government in Kiev, and its primary sponsor, the Obama administration, have a problem. The Russians are not incorrect, legalistically, in saying that the government has no legitimacy, that it's an illegitimate government. Therefore, the wager is in Washington and in Kiev that by holding a presidential, not a parliamentary, but a presidential election, the government will be headed by somebody who's actually elected and acquire legitimacy. The problem here is it begs the question, what was the hurry? Well, the hurry was political to get this legitimacy. But remember that in February, just before the elected president was overthrown, the European Union, excuse me, John, brokered an arrangement with Yanukovych that there would be new presidential elections in December, not May 25th, not this Sunday, but 7 months from now. And the assumption was is that that would give Ukraine time to campaign, to arrange for candidates who represented different points of view on the major problems facing the country, both domestic and foreign, to articulate their positions and have something like an orderly election. But the rush to do it this Sunday has abandoned all the niceties that we associate with elections. For example, the two major parties of the eastern part of the country, and those are considered to be the regions that have an affinity for Russia, not for the West, the two major parties have been badly intimidated by force, by the street forces of the Kiev government. Its presidential candidates have been assaulted in the streets. A number of them have dropped out. And the two parties themselves, it's the party called the Party of the Regions, that was the former president's party, and the Ukrainian Communist Party, which had, I believe, about 80 deputies, have been persecuted to the point where the Kiev government is now trying to ban the Ukrainian Communist Party altogether in Ukraine. So it raises a question. If the East does not have candidates that represent it, and if the East does not have political parties to campaign that represent it, what is the value of this election? And even if the turnout is decent, as it may well be in central and western Ukraine, there's another possibility. The hope is this will be a kind of legitimizing form of unifying the country. The alternative is it will result in the practical partition of the country. The West will have an elected president that the East will not recognize. And that brings us to the candidate, simply to say that though Poroshenko is likely to win, if not in the first, he got to win 50% plus one votes to win. If he doesn't win on the first ballot, he's likely to win on the second. But it really wouldn't matter, because if he's not recognized by people in the East, then he's president of half of Ukraine, and arguably you're worse off now than you were before the election because a de facto partition has occurred. That's the danger.
Let me be positive. Poroshenko, the chocolate king, is a man who will have the power of the presidency. Therefore, that gives him the ability to control, to restrain the very threatening remarks that have come from Kiev these last weeks.
Wait, John. I'd never like to correct you, because usually you're more right than I am. But here there's a problem. If this would be true, what you just said, if they were acting on the Ukrainian constitution that the last president was acting on, the president had most of the powers.
Right.
But part of the agreement that Yanukovych made that was brokered by the European Union in February was to return to the previous constitution, I think it was the 1997, but I forget the date, which gave predominant power to the parliament. And that is the constitution that this government in Kiev is now operating on. So if it's the old constitution, no, the president will have very little power. The power will still be in the hands of the parliament. And by the way, a very big by the way, all logic, if you really want to unify Ukraine, would be to have a parliamentary election as well. But the parliament has refused for two reasons. Those deputies know that they're not popular in the country. They've presided over this civil war or new cold war or whatever it is. They don't want to go home and try to get reelected. But secondly, they're worried that a new parliament would change the constitution yet again and restore power to the president. So they're very happy, the current parliament, not having to face reelections, and by the constitution they're now using, being superior in power to the president. Otherwise, I don't think they would have the presidential election. They're not going to risk somebody getting elected and taking power from this parliament, which is essentially the Kiev government.
What you surprise me, Steve, because if that's the case, this election is a fiction. It doesn't change the driving problem, which is Kiev's...
Let's go to Putin. Now, that's what Putin was saying 2 weeks ago, that this is a fiction. And what are you doing? And we're opposed to this, and it's going to make things worse. And if you want to have an election, you need the whole country. You got to sort out the constitutional issues first. You need time. Let's go back to the December timetable. And the United States said, and I mean the United States says incredibly unwise things, if you oppose the March 25 election, they said to Putin, that's the one this Sunday, we will put more sanctions on you. I mean, why in the world the elections are related to sanctions? Only somebody in Washington knows. So Putin backed off. And last week he made a statement and said, well, if you feel strongly about the elections, go ahead. And that's the Russian position. But their private position is it's not going to be good for Ukraine or for East-West relations. That it's not a fiction, but it's a mistake.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Russian History Emeritus, as well as at Princeton University, the author of two pieces at The Nation, New Cold War, Who's Responsible, and A Cold War Without Debate. That's where we are right now. There's no debate in this country. In fact, there wasn't even a question at the White House last Friday. Not even a question about Ukraine. This is not just about some part of the Black Sea Basin. This is about a Cold War between Washington and Moscow that is chilling relations across the globe. Mr. Putin is right now in China for a two-day visit. That is part of this challenge. When we come back, however, I will mention and ask Steve's help on the news out of Treasury today that 12 more Russian citizens were sanctioned under the so-called Magnitsky Act. This is, to my knowledge, a parallel universe to Ukraine, but it certainly doesn't improve the relationship between Moscow and Washington. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, is here with me to explain these odd headlines we're getting from Ukraine crisis. We've spoken of Poroshenko, the chocolate king, leading in all the polling, likely to be the, and he could evenly win the first round and take more than 50%, be the president of Ukraine, replacing Mr. Yanukovych, though his powers are limited. Perhaps he'll pass out chocolate and win favors. But now this headline. Steve, I read from ITAR TASS, because that's a major news agency in Moscow, and they're reading it right now as they're waking up this morning. U.S. imposes sanctions against 12 Russians under Magnitsky Act. The United States imposes sanctions against 12 Russian citizens under the so-called Magnitsky Act, press service of the Department of Treasury said on Tuesday. This is not Ukraine, Steve, but it's a headline. It's a major headline in ITAR TASS. It certainly looks like it's chillier and chillier on the Cold War. What is the Magnitsky Act and why now?
We talked about it when it was passed, I think, about 18 months ago. It was a congressional act. There's a man named William Browder, once upon a time an American financial man who went to Russia in the 90s, made a lot of money in Russia, had one of the largest investment firms there. To be a little crude, he lay down with dogs, other Russian oligarchs, and he got up with fleas, and he got fleeced. And he got very angry, and he went to war against him. He was not allowed to re-enter the country. Some of his wealth was confiscated through tax scams. He hired a lawyer by the name of Sergei Magnitsky, Russian lawyer. Seems to have been a very honorable man. Not a civil rights activist, but a lawyer. He pursued a case. He was arrested by the Russian authorities. He was mistreated in prison. He died in prison. Browder then privatized American foreign policy. He used his contacts and his wealth to persuade a number of uninformed Democratic and Republican congressmen to enact this act. And it's actually a kind of form of McCarthyism, because it says that anybody who violates human rights in Russia can be put on the so-called Magnitsky list, named after the man who died. And if they're put on the list, their assets, and possibly the assets of their relatives, in the United States can be confiscated, and they themselves are not allowed to enter the United States. There is no recourse. There is no due process. So, for example, I think I gave you this example when this act was passed. If I had a Russian business partner, and we were doing fine, and I decided I wanted to bankrupt him so I could buy his half of my business, if I could get a congressman to believe that my Russian business partner had violated human rights, and his name was put on that list, he would be financially wounded, and I could take over the business. This is not the way American jurisprudence works. We have due process in this country. And for the Congress to pass a bill that does not provide any recourse, any due process, where charges can be brought anonymously and never made public, this is simply not an honorable thing. It reminds us that much American policy is not analysis, is not national security thinking, but it's attitude. And the attitude that's prevailed for going on 10 years is that Putin is an exceedingly evil man, and that anything we do that we think strikes Putin is a virtuous thing. That's faulty reasoning. But that's how the Magnitsky Act arose. Now, the problem here for Obama is he doesn't really control it. It came out of Congress, and it has a mechanism whereby if Congress can produce certain documents, the Obama administration, in this case, I think the Treasury, but it could also be the State Department, took the position, we have our own list of sanctioned Russians we don't allow in this country. But Congress wanted its own. So if Congress does X, Y, and Z, Treasury has to sanction more people. That it would come now, during the worst East-West American-Russian confrontation since the Cuban Missile Crisis, shows once again that we have a Congress that can't think about international affairs, that can't think about national security. Of 525 elected members of Congress, one, and you're going to have to help me with his name again, Republican Congressman Dana Raschbacher of California, I believe.
Rohrabacher,
challenged last week, I believe it was, the State Department policy in Kiev, arguing that we were abetting neo-fascists in Kiev. Very courageous thing he did. I have no affinity for his other politics, but this was a lonely and courageous thing. But meanwhile, plenty of congressmen seem to have time to ferret out Russians they think violate other Russians' human rights and get them on this blacklist called the Magnitsky List and sanction them. It's in every respect, whether we look to Congress, as the Constitution does, to help make American foreign policy, Congress has failed utterly, totally, or whether we look to Congress to simply be democratic and create legislation that reflects our democratic due process, judicial values. When it comes to Russia, Congress just fails repeatedly.
The names on this list, these 12 names, these are not big deals. These are not rich people. They're police officers and officers of prisons and detention centers. In other words, they're sanctioning the working class. It works for the Russian state. They're sanctioning the working class. My question, my puzzlement, Steve, this is May 20th. The election is May 25th. The observers are pouring into Ukraine. There are guns everywhere. And we're carrying on as if none of this is happening. Does that mean that the Obama administration gets off on this because they can't control their own foreign policy?
I would put it differently and more broadly, but similarly, that what we're witnessing in Ukraine and in this confrontation between the United States and Russia is the collapse, total collapse, of a bipartisan American policy toward Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. It began in the 1990s, and it's continued today. And the fact that it was so bipartisan helps to explain, does not entirely explain, but helps to explain why there is no protest, no debate in either party about this policy. And I have to say, and I voted for Obama twice, that in the context of this worst national security crisis of our time, he has become the diminishing president. He is all but vanished. When he says something, it bears no relationship to the reality on the ground in Ukraine. And increasingly, he says nothing. Secretary of State John Kerry, when he speaks, sounds like a Secretary of War. There's no diplomacy in his language.
The
Russians are begging for diplomacy. The Americans, it appears, are encouraging war.
Mr. Putin is doing diplomacy. He's in China. When we come back, what does that mean for Ukraine crisis and for the new Cold War? Steve Cohen, I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine crisis. There's an election on Sunday. Vladimir Putin, he's not hanging around Moscow worrying about the election. He's in Shanghai. He's gone for a two-day state visit to China. There are headlines right now moving the story from BBC London and from Al Jazeera America. I'll start with the symbolic headline from Al Jazeera America. Russia and China have signed the Agreement on Cooperation. That's what it's called. This is a step towards undercutting the domination of the U.S. dollar as the international reserve currency. It's just a step. It's the beginning of China and Russia looking to use some other currency besides the dollar. Does this mean that it's going to happen tonight? No. The important headline, however, we're waiting for. The Russian gas deal, Gazprom to Sinuk. This is energy, the same energy that Russia has, that Europe needs, that Germany needs, the same energy that Ukraine needs. Well, so does China. And right now, the headline out of the BBC says that Mr. Putin, starting a two-day visit with a major gas supply deal on the agenda. A price was not agreed on Tuesday, the first day of the visit. Remember, this is 10, 12 hours ahead of us. But analysts, according to BBC, say a deal could be struck before Mr. Putin leaves China on Wednesday. Steve, I want to describe this relationship as profound because these are the two powers of the supercontinent of Eurasia. Russia in the pivot position, that's 100 years old, that's geography, and China as the aspirational wingman here to come together and dominate Asian security and Asian energy. This is part of Ukraine's story, but let's just focus on China right now. This move was always going to happen, Steve. This isn't being driven by the Cold War. However, the Cold War, this new Cold War between Moscow and Washington, underlines that the United States has fallen out of step with the other world powers for the 21st century.
Well, I think you're right, and I guess I'll take this occasion to tap my own drum. I've been arguing since the early 1990s, when this winner-take-all, Russia lost the Cold War, we are the only superpower policy toward post-Soviet Russia began, that if we keep pushing Russia as though it has no options other than to bend to the United States, that it will move toward the option it has, and it's China. And I was told in the 1990s, and as recently as a couple years ago, that was impossible, because Russians were racist, because Russia's economy was weak and China's was strong, because Russia is underpopulated in Siberia and China's overpopulated and Chinese will spread into Siberia, and that the Russians would never get into the geopolitical bed with China. But you and I have discussed this, gosh, John, whenever we began our discussions, and my argument was, and I think you agreed, that while we think that Russia thinks America is its most important relationship, for a number of years, in fact, for Moscow, Berlin and Beijing have been its two most important relationships. And now, with Berlin fading to some degree, along with the West, from Russia's national security priorities, Russia is moving even faster toward China. And the symbolism, as you say, as it's shown on Russian television, I don't know the degree to which it was shown on American television, but as the Ukrainian crisis unfolds and Putin's triumphant arrival in China and the welcome he was given and what they discussed and the perspective of a 30-year relationship and the symbolism of discussing a new financial system, reminds us of a couple things. We think, well, we'll sanction Russia. Well, Russia could sanction us. They could sanction us by agreeing with China to stop using the dollar for transactions. And other Asian nations would join them, by the way. And the BRIC nations might join them. Moreover, Russia has, I'm not sure about the number, but I think about $300 billion in American treasury notes, government security notes. They could dump them and invest their money someplace else. That would be a crushing blow to the American treasury note bond market. Russia has a lot of things it could do that would be very, very bad for the American economy. And a lot of it will do with China, which we are told within two or three, certainly 6 years, will surpass the United States as the largest economy in the world. Underlying this is a market reality. Russia has boundless energy, not only the gas that China wants, but oil, which China will also take. Russia has weapons. It sells most of its weapons to India and to China. It has weapons China wants and needs. Russia has held back on some sophisticated weapon systems, but it might no longer hold back. And China has a market that, you know, that could replace the European market for Russian energy. So it does seem to me, though Russia will pay a certain price in the transition, that if we're going to look at this as a big chessboard game, it's Russia that holds the cards, not Washington.
The quotes from the BBC, Mr. Putin called China, quote, Russia's reliable friend.
Yep.
Mr. Putin also said, it would be no exaggeration if I said that the cooperation between our two countries is at its highest level in history. I hope some lights are going on at the State Department. I want to go back to this.
Well, I mean, I think we should remember that that's a very profound statement, because relations were very, very bad when both countries were communist countries. They fought a war on their 4,000-mile border, did the Soviet Union and China. And things have gotten progressively better and better, but under Putin, it's really soared. And not only because it makes market sense for Russia. I mean, Russia is a capitalist country of perhaps a crude but animated kind, and China is a market and a producer, a consumer that Russia needs and wants, but it's also been driven by what can only be viewed as anti-Russian policy coming out of Washington for 20 years, which is crescendoed now in this Ukrainian crisis. So there is a logic to this.
I underline that Moscow sells 80% of its energy to the West. And so if there are going to be any limits placed on that, such as Gazprom sanctions or Rosneft sanctions, we don't know what's ahead. It is good business right now for Russia to seek another outlet, and that would be China. I also underline the fact that though they've had bumpy relations these last 60 or 70 years, right now, Steve, they're attending a conference. Note this, 40 countries and international organizations in Shanghai. This is a summit of Asian states, and in attendance are Iran, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, and Cambodia. Some of those are part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which China and Russia and the Stans have already started participating in. But Iran and Pakistan, add in India, we're looking at a collective that is anything but dependent upon the United States or NATO or Western Europe. And it's not only self-sufficient, it dominates Eurasia.
Well, I mean, Russia is geographically, as we all know, positioned to have the best of both worlds. It is a Eurasian country. Half of it sits in Asia, half of it geographically in Europe. And in fact, you know, it affects Russia's culture. Some of it Eastern, some of it's Western. But where this Chinese-Russian relationship might go needs to be considered by Washington. There are people in Moscow and Beijing who want to create the equivalent of NATO between China and Russia and anybody who would wish to join them, which conceivably could even mean India, but a lot of these smaller countries you've mentioned. And when you look at it in terms of world population, overwhelmingly,
right.
Overwhelmingly, when we talk about isolating Russia, that's the mantra of Obama. We're going to isolate Russia. What are they talking about?
I don't know.
It's so Western-centric. It's as though I would say, I'm not going to talk to John Batchelor anymore. Now he's on his own.
Right.
He's alone. It's preposterous. It's not a foreign policy. It's not a national security strategy. It's a kind of attitude. And it's so reckless and dangerous that people don't think things through. And we're seeing today the things you're mentioning, what Russia's alternatives are. Now, I hasten to say that there are a lot of people in the Russian policy elite who don't want to go any farther with China. They don't want to give up the Western ties. They want both. But if we're pushing them out of the West, as we move NATO physically, its troops, closer and closer to Russia's borders, as we talk, Russia will turn its back on the West.
I appeal to everyone at home with the globe. Look at the globe. Look at Asia and Europe. You see that? They're not separated. They're one supercontinent, Eurasia. All right, take the Middle East, and it connects to Africa. Africa is natural resources. China needs it. That's the sea routes from China through the Indian Ocean. The subcontinent connects very neatly with the supercontinent of Eurasia. That's called the World Island. This is 100 years old. This is geography. The World Island does not need the United States. We have no success in intervening in the World Island with our military. The only success we can enjoy over this next century is trade. Europe, ask yourself, if you're Berlin, Paris, and London, where is your strength? Is it in Washington across the Atlantic with our, what you'd have to say, unpredictable politics? Or is it in Moscow? Is it in Beijing where you have markets and you have energy? That's the question that Mr. Putin and his counselors and Xi Jinping and his counselors have in front of them right now. And I think they're going to make practical decisions. Steve, Ukraine crisis, we're going to come back to it, but I asked this question at the end. Mr. Obama is prosecuting a Ukraine crisis politics that doesn't seem to have an end game. He's putting pressure on Moscow without telling us where he's going.
And that aggrieves me personally more than anything, because I am utterly, totally convinced that a diplomatic solution to the Ukrainian crisis is before our eyes, within our grasp, but Washington seems uninterested in it. I don't know why, but it's there. Everybody knows what the Russians want. Everybody knows what most Ukrainians want and what Ukraine needs. Germany appears to understand this, but the United States is still the Bigfoot in this story, and it seems unwilling to follow this lead. Unless there's something secret we don't know, it's a tragedy unfolding.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University's Russian History Emeritus in both, and he's the author of two articles, The New Cold War, Who's Responsible, and The Cold War Without Debate. When we come back, what to watch for these next days with Putin in China, what to watch for from that conversation in Shanghai, and to watch for in Kiev, because there are very, very angry voices in Kiev that can upset what looks to be stability. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Steve Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, is here, and we're discussing Ukraine crisis, the pending vote on Sunday. Mr. Putin in China. There are other voices in Ukraine, however. They're not global, they're local, and they're violent. The man at the center of this inquiry is he's called the Minister of National Security. His name is Andriy Poruby. I'm told that he was the commander of Maidan, the protest. He is a man who's associated with violence. He's a man associated with dispatching so-called men in black to the eastern provinces to fight the separatists. There are rumors that Poruby is being assisted by mercenaries, soldiers of fortune from outside Ukraine, just rumors. But those rumors have currency in the world of Ukraine, where news reporting is iffy and Moscow media dominates one part of the country, Kiev media dominates another. Steve, this man, Poruby, I don't know him. I just I've heard tell of him being violent and threatening. His self-interest is to continue the turmoil, not to resolve this. Is there a check to him in Ukraine?
Not yet, but he is significant, but he's symbolic. He's representative of a larger danger that people in the United States who support the White House policy do not want to discuss, and that is that something resembling a neo-fascist movement, let's don't use the word, let's just say an ultra-nationalist Ukrainian movement that tends, in some of its views, toward racial, ethnic, fascist views, has been present in Ukraine, especially in Western Ukraine, for many years, and it appeared as part, only part, of the Maidan protest against the last Ukrainian elected president, Yanukovych. It was a small part. It was not the majority. But as the protest grew and tensions grew, it was that smaller part that became the violent part of the protest. These were the young toughs in black masks who were throwing Molotov cocktails at police, that were storming buildings, that were occupying buildings. Now, when the government came to power, that's now in power, it's a coalition government, and part of the coalition is the Svoboda, or Freedom Party. This is an ultra-nationalist party, and it was characterized by the European Parliament in December 2012 as racist, anti-Semitic, and incompatible with European values. That is part of the government today that we now embrace, and its right wing, its fighting wing, its street guys is called the right sector. And this Svoboda party now holds five ministries in the Kiev government. Some of them are the so-called power ministries, the national security ministries, the internal affairs ministries. And this man that you just mentioned, being one of them, now is the man who's dispatching troops to put down the insurgents in the east. And because the Ukrainian military has not been reliable, he recruited these armed militia, these, I don't even want to use the word quasi-fascists, these ultra-nationalist tough guys in the streets of Kiev and western Ukraine, and turned them into what he calls the National Guard. And they have been doing a lot of the fighting and attacking in eastern Ukraine. And there are two aspects of this that are very, very bad. Everybody agreed, Russia, Ukraine, the United States in April in Geneva, that the first steps towards negotiation was de-escalating violence. But since then, the Kiev government, our government, has continued to send more and more of these extremist troops to eastern Ukraine. Secondly, atrocities have been committed. In Odessa, 40-plus people were burned to death in a building. In Mariupol, civilians were killed. In Slavyansk, civilians were killed. Now, the answer is that the insurgents there are armed, and they killed people too. But it's also the case that most of their violence was in self-defense. They were fighting against the troops sent from Kiev. And there's one other thing. The United States has not protested these atrocities committed by its own government in Kiev. When asked about Odessa, when 40 people were burned to death in a building, about the civilian deaths in Mariupol and Slavyansk, about tanks entering residential areas of a city where atrocities are inevitable, Psakovsky, whatever her name is, the spokesman of the State Department, and others in the American government, Samantha Powers at the UN, said, Kiev has a right to restore law and order. I find that as an American offensive, because some of what is happening in Ukraine, committed by the Kiev government, is rising to the level of war crimes, and that's not restoring law and order. And as an American, I feel ashamed that the representatives of the American government would not say instead, "This should not be happening. We will investigate. We will urge restraint. We disapprove of this." Instead, in issuing statements that, in effect, justify it. This is really very bad, John.
Sunday's the election. We have 2 weeks until the 70th anniversary of D-Day.
Yep.
All the leaders will be there. Mr. Putin's invited. Mr. Obama's certainly invited and will attend. The question here is, will this be a meeting of the minds? Will this defuse it? We have 30 seconds, Steve, but I mentioned that Mrs. Merkel is very eager to defuse this and to settle it. Will D-Day give her an opportunity to bring everybody together?
Well, the French are the hosts, I believe, because it's taking place in Normandy, where the Allied forces landed in June 1944. Will Putin come? He's been invited by the French. I think he will come only on one condition, that official tribute is paid to the reality that it was the Red Soviet Russian Army that destroyed Hitler's war machine on the Eastern Front, and that the Normandy landing, which opened the Second Front 3 years after Russia was attacked, was extremely important. But it was basically a cleaning up campaign. The Russians had already defeated.
Professor Steve Cohen of NYU in Princeton, I'm John Batchelor.